From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, turning everyday objects into colossal public monuments, we talk with sculptor Klaus Oldenburg. He created a giant clothespin for Philadelphia, a rubber stamp for Cleveland, and a fruit bowl for Miami. Also, we talked to golfer Charlie Sifford, the first African-American admitted to the PGA. After playing golf for 40 years, he says he still doesn't see any room for a black in golf. And film critic John Powers reviews Honeymoon in Vegas, starring Nicolas Cage and Sarah Jessica Parker. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Bush has announced the sale of 150 F-16 fighter jets to Taiwan. The deal is worth $6 billion in sales for General Dynamics, and it's expected to save about 3,000 jobs. The president has been under intense pressure from both the weapons industry and members of Congress to reverse his long-standing opposition to the sale. The decision goes against a 1982 agreement with China, which calls for reducing arms sales to Taiwan and eventually phasing them out. The president made his announcement at the General Dynamics plant in Fort Worth during a campaign swing through Texas. The president used a South Dakota farm as a backdrop today to announce a new subsidies program for wheat exports. From South Dakota Public Radio, Paulette Pippert reports.
The president says he is expanding the export enhancement program so that 1 billion bushels of U.S. wheat will be available to 28 nations.
This is the largest quantity of wheat ever made available under the EAP program at one time. And there is no question that in a world of open trade, the U.S. would be the premier supplier of wheat to world markets. And that's why we are committed to reducing subsidies worldwide.
President Bush also has released $755 million in emergency disaster aid to help farmers whose crops have been devastated by bad weather. For National Public Radio, I'm Paulette Pippert in Sioux Falls, South Dakota.
In Homestead, Florida, people started filtering into the first of the tent cities to be set up by the military. Kathy Lohr reports.
By late afternoon, less than 100 people had signed in at the Red Cross tent in this military-looking camp that's been put together for people who've lost their homes. Cecil Lettuce with the Red Cross says so far he hasn't seen people rushing to get in, but he hopes they will decide to accept this shelter.
We know that the city of Homestead is ordering people out of their homes because they're not safe to live in. We also know that there's a reluctance on the part of those people to leave their belongings for fear of being robbed and looted and those kinds of things.
With the city of Homestead condemning property, the tent cities may be a lot of people's only option. In Homestead, Florida, I'm Kathy Lohr reporting.
Hurricane Andrew may put a severe crimp in U.S. oil and gas production in the Gulf of Mexico. The Federal Minerals Management Service said today that the storm did severe damage to more than 100 offshore oil and natural gas platforms. Most oil rig workers were evacuated before the hurricane struck, and there were no reports of deaths or injuries. The agency said that the damage has temporarily cut off about 1 billion cubic feet of the 15 billion produced in the Gulf each day. On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 24 points to finish the day at 3,290. This is NPR News. An Iraqi official denied today that his government is preparing to attack Shiite Muslim dissidents in southern Iraq. The comments came from the governor of a southern province who spoke to reporters making a tour of the region. The governor also said that his forces have been ordered not to shoot at any allied aircraft that are policing the no-fly zone. The United Nations will begin sending observers to South Africa this weekend. They'll be charged with monitoring conditions there to help prevent violence from breaking out in the townships. NPR's Jim Zaroli reports.
A UN spokesman said about a dozen observers will go to South Africa this weekend. Eventually, about 50 observers will be sent to the country. The spokesman said the full team will be deployed after a team leader is named. More than 6,000 people are believed to have been killed in violence in South Africa's black townships since 1990. The government attributes the deaths to fighting between Nelson Mandela's African National Congress and the Inkatha Freedom Party. But the ANC blames the government for the fighting, and in response has boycotted peace talks. UN officials are hoping that the presence of observers will help reduce tensions among the factions and lead to a resumption of the talks. The UN team is expected to be supplemented by observers from the European Community and the Organization of African Unity. In New York, this is Jim Zaroli reporting.
A federal judge in Philadelphia ruled today that the Massachusetts Institute of Technology violated antitrust laws when it cooperated with other colleges to determine financial aid levels for students. MIT was the only one of nine Ivy League schools involved in the case that chose to go to trial. The schools were charged with price fixing for setting up a financial aid formula for undergraduate students. MIT said the arrangement didn't financially benefit the school and was merely a charitable program designed to ensure that qualified students got adequate financial aid. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The artist Klaus Oldenburg once said, "I am for art that embroils itself in everyday crap and still comes out on top." Oldenburg and his wife and partner Kusche van Bruggen have designed a series of colossal public sculptures in the shapes of everyday objects. Cleveland has a giant rubber stamp. Miami has a fruit ball. Chicago, a giant baseball bat. Las Vegas has a flashlight. The monuments have always been controversial, but as art critic Robert Hughes once wrote, no living artist combines the roles of magician and clown with as much skill as Oldenburg. His achievement has been to take an extraordinary range of banal objects and invest them with consistent metaphoric power. Oldenburg was born in Sweden, but he grew up in Chicago. One of Oldenburg's sculptures is a giant 45-foot-high clothespin. It's across the street from City Hall in Philadelphia, where I live. It's easily my favorite public sculpture in the city. I spoke with Oldenburg last spring, and I told him that on even the most humdrum day, I'm cheered up by the clothespin's wit and graceful design.
What you're experiencing, I think, would be one of the things that Kosh and I would be hoping for, is that it would do something in the landscape that would be different, would be surprising, and it's not always humorous, but I mean, there's an element there, sometimes of the unexpected, which can be humorous, and the clothespin is an example of a sculpture that is quite formal. Some of the things we've done since then have been freer, but this one is very formal and very much like the structures in the city. So it's a kind of variation on a skyscraper, and its origin really goes back to a variation on a skyscraper in Chicago that was a famous competition in 1922 for a design for the Tribune, Chicago Tribune Tower. And when the first drawing of the clothespin was made in 1967, it was made as a late submission to that competition. In other words, a variation, a kind of Gothic variation of the building that won the competition, which is, as you all know, a Gothic structure.
Although you've been doing these sculptures for years, they've never ceased becoming controversial. For instance, you designed a rubber stamp, and this was a commission for the Standard Oil headquarters in Cleveland. It was commissioned in 1985, but then British Petroleum bought Standard Oil, and they rejected the completed sculpture. Why did they reject it?
Well, they've never said exactly why they rejected it, but it probably had something to do with the fact that they didn't want to appear to be what they called a rubber stamp of the company they'd taken over. I suppose this there's something about the name rubber stamp which has a negative connotation, though that's not the way that Kosh and I see it. We see it as a normal, humble office object, just like a clothespin that can be subject for a sculpture. However, this particular stamp wasn't really known as the rubber stamp. It was known as the free stamp, and that's because on the stamp it said free. That was the concept from the beginning. So it had it went a little bit beyond the idea of enlarging a rubber stamp.
Do you think it violates the rules when a company buys another company and reneges on their commitment to buy the sculpture?
Well, it violates a contract we had, and of course that leaves us with very little option since we couldn't sue the company. But by a long process of citizen action, really, the sculpture came back as a sculpture for the city of Cleveland. And now it's no longer in front of a private building. It's next to the city hall, so it has a more universal application. So we feel that the end result of this 9-year process was really positive, after all, and that the piece as it's now installed, which is on its side rather than standing up, is what was the destiny for the piece all along.
How tall is the rubber stamp now?
The free stamp.
The free stamp, yes.
Well, the free stamp is about 60 feet long. At this point, since it's lying on its side,
right,
we won't speak of it standing up. It rises from the ground about 25 feet, and then it lies about 60 feet.
You know, when it became a city monument instead of a corporate monument, it still got some angry reactions. I was reading some of the press coverage in Cleveland, and some of the columnists are saying, you know, what kind of art is this? Why do you think people get upset when an ordinary object is used as the subject of art?
Well, I don't know if that's what upsets people, but of course the tradition in public sculpture is to create something hierarchical, which is up on a pedestal, and people are perhaps surprised when that tradition is turned on its head and you get instead a very simple object that most people probably don't feel belongs on a pedestal. But in modern times, it seems that such an object is more appropriate than, say, an equestrian statue. But people get angry for many reasons, and very often a public sculpture, because of its because it gets a lot of attention, is used by people to promote their own causes. And politicians will use it to make a case of some sort, which will call attention to themselves. I think it's very good that that people do discuss and raise controversies over sculptures. Kosha and I feel that it wouldn't be right somehow to put up something that everybody would agree on, that we have a responsibility as artists to practice the same approach that we do in private, which is to say to create something that has a bit of an edge, that lies a little bit ahead of general consciousness, or try to do that. So when that's transferred into public art, it does make people sometimes surprised, though they do get used to it.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me ask you about the controversy surrounding one other city sculpture that you did, and this was one for the city of Miami. It was called Drop Bowl with Scattered Slices and Peels. Let me ask you to describe it.
Well, the concept was of a bowl dropped into a plaza, a giant bowl, very large bowl, which contained slices of oranges and peels of oranges and some kind of a liquid, which wasn't exactly defined, that became the fountain element, the water element.
Mm-hmm.
And the bowl hit the plaza and scattered into seven pieces and seven fragments, and then the insides, what was inside, went flying out too. And this was all realized almost like a snapshot or a still moment of movement. And then it was realized in concrete and plastic and metal, and the water element was introduced. So what this was really was a translation of the traditional idea of a fountain, which usually has some kind of a bowl and figures in it, and it was taking that notion and sort of shattering it. This was Kosh's reaction to the situation there, which was a very formal situation that was forced on us. She said, well, why don't we just break the bowl and scatter the pieces? And that way the sculpture was less monolithic and it could take in a lot more space.
Now, part of the controversy around this particular piece was over the safety aspects of it. One person cut his leg after falling into one of the pools that catches the water from the fountain. Then a disabled rights group said that all the kind of jagged edges, all the edges, I should say, created a hazard for the blind. What was your reaction to that, and did you take those kinds of safety considerations into account when designing it?
Well, we met with various groups after the sculpture was put up, and we agreed on certain precautions.
Mm-hmm.
There are some buttons marking the edges of the sculpture and other warning systems, so that issue is settled. I feel that in any public sculpture will be as dangerous as it is just to move around in the city. I know if you just, I was just on the street here in New York, and for 1 minute I didn't concentrate, and I nearly got clipped by a taxi. So I think that awareness like that is something you bring to your appreciation of a sculpture in the middle of the city. But, of course, there are special considerations for people who are handicapped and people who are blind. And we meet these considerations and discuss them and then do what we can.
Is there much graffiti on any of your public sculpture? And I'm wondering if there is, how you feel about it, given your love of the kind of vitality of the city and everyday objects. You could make an argument that graffiti fits right into that.
Well, I think you could, but it really does interfere with the intentions of the sculpture. And it varies a great deal. Depends on the location and how much care is taken to keep the sculpture up. Of course, a public sculpture is a very prominent location. And for people who want to call attention to themselves, it's the best place to write. So it often does happen. But in most of the locations, there is attention to this detail. We were just in Barcelona, where we put up a large sculpture in the Olympics program. And there they are going to a lot of trouble to keep it painted. As I say, it depends on the situation and the place.
Which sculpture has had the most graffiti?
Well, we have one that has reached a point of graffiti coverage where it has almost ceased to be a sculpture, and that's in Münster, Germany, where we created the pool balls, which are three concrete balls in a park in the middle of the city. And from the very beginning, these balls were used as bulletin boards, kind of, for the expression of personal and political feelings and posters and whatever. And we tried to scrape them down, but after a while we realized if we kept scraping, there'd be no sculpture left. So then we tried painting, but that didn't seem to do much good. So after a while, we just left it alone. And we look at them now as spherical billboards and have publicly disowned them as sculptures.
I'm interested in the roots of how you started doing these oversized, now colossal, sculptures of ordinary objects. You started doing this kind of work in much smaller versions, I believe it was in the early 1960s. What was on your mind then that led you in that direction?
Well, the first large-scale work was in 1969, which was the lipstick for Yale University. Before that, I'd been doing fantastic drawings of real sites, such as the clothespin I mentioned, where they were called proposed colossal monuments. Another one was the Good Humor Bar as a substitute for the Pan Am building on Park Avenue. And there were many situations like that were proposed where the existing building had something in common with something much smaller. Like a Pan Am definitely has the shape of a Good Humor Bar, and the substitution was made in the media of drawing and as convincingly as possible. But in 69, these drawings were well known to the students of architecture at Yale University. And when Herbert Marcuse, the socialist philosopher, came to lecture, they purposely asked him what would happen to society if some of these structures were built. And Marcuse replied that if that happened, then capitalist society would be at an end. So this stimulated the students to commission a sculpture on a large scale, a real version of these fantastic proposals. And so I got the commission to do a sculpture for the center of Yale University. And this was, of course, all done surreptitiously, and the authorities weren't asked. So the sculpture was prepared in secret and brought into Beinecke Plaza, which is the war memorial at the center of the university. And this was in the late 60s, and the mood, of course, was very combative, and the students were very involved. And it was a very exciting moment, and the authorities sort of decided to let it happen because they thought if they stepped in and prevented it, much worse things could occur. So the sculpture did get put up, and that was the first large-scale project.
My guest is sculptor Klaus Oldenburg. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Artist Klaus Oldenburg is my guest. What is it about ordinary objects that you take such pleasure in?
Well, I've always been very interested in deriving my art from my surroundings, from my daily experiences. And so my daily experiences are not very adventurous or dramatic. They tend to revolve around very simple things, just as most people's. And there came a moment when I saw these things as potential sculptures, razor blades, toothbrushes, soaps, whatever. I thought they have a certain character and identity and formal quality in themselves, which could be used as sculpture. And this was something which just came naturally. It also is important to me that I can touch all these things in a small scale, and I can feel the object completely, say, in a small scale before I proceed to making a large version of it. So it has very personal origins, which later became involved with the general practices of pop art and so on. But this interest in smaller objects had a personal origin.
Were you ever interested in a more classical, traditional art?
Well, I'm still interested in classical, traditional art, and the kind of art that I've done very often makes references to traditional art and tries to establish links with it. A large raisin bread, for example, has something in it of David's painting of Madame Récamier, things like that. There are allusions and references which try to connect the present with the past, which I think is a very important thing, not to lose history. That is to be in advance in some ways, but not to forget what's gone before.
Mm-hmm. We can see your art in public spaces, in Cleveland, in Philadelphia, in Miami, in many cities in Europe and the United States. Do you feel lucky in a way that you can make public sculpture, that one doesn't need to go inside a museum or a gallery to see your work? Is that the way you'd most like it to be?
Well, in 1978, when Kosch and I, after a brief period in Holland, moved back to America, we deliberately set out to put art outdoors and make it more accessible because we didn't like the gallery system where the artwork gets lost and goes into a vault and is never seen again and is seen, if at all, by very few people. So we wanted to create a work for more people and a work that participated with the real world. So we set out to do this series of large-scale projects. In 1985, we had come to the point where we thought perhaps it would be interesting to go back to some work that was more personal and more, say, gallery-oriented, because we were really losing touch with that part of the art scene.
Mm-hmm.
The fact is that when you go into public art, you definitely cut yourself off from the art scene, because it's a very specialized activity. And you find that it's mostly reported in architecture magazines or in the daily press. And art magazines kind of go in another direction completely. But with the performance in Venice, Italy, of the Cotello, the Corso del Cotello, which Kosha had stimulated and which we did with the aid of many people in Italy, students and companies, the work went back to a smaller scale. And since then, we have been working inside of galleries as well as outside of galleries.
You live in Manhattan, in the Soho area.
That's right.
What do you see in the city that gives you the kind of excitement, the kind of delight, visual pleasure, irony, whatever that you hope your sculpture gives to other people? What do you see that gives you that feeling? That's either art or just happens to be there.
Well, in a city like New York, there's so many things, and there's so many moods. And there's so many different states of weather and so many people. There's so much that it's very difficult to isolate anything. If Kosha and I concentrate on something, we finally manage to find some kind of a focus in a city for our thinking. In Des Moines, it was the umbrella. We have still not done anything for New York City, and it's a difficult city to do anything for, because there is really a lot here. I mean, the skyscrapers and the towers and the traffic and the many human beings. It's just a little overwhelming, and you feel that perhaps the sculpture might get lost in all of it. And if you did do a sculpture, you couldn't summarize it somehow. It's just too big. There's another element about New York, and that is that it's in constant process. And one feels that that there's something inconsistent about a permanent work in the streets of New York. So I don't know. At one point, I had proposed a work that would be just a car on the subway, and it just would ride around underground. And it would just have a certain character of its own. And every time it would come into the station, there would be the monument. And some people might never see it at all, and some people might see it all too often. But it would always be in movement.
That's a lovely idea. I really like that.
Well, I think that New York is a place which makes you think about different solutions, which is one reason that it's nice to live here. It's a very tough city, but if you're in fortunate enough to be in a situation where you can observe it from a distance, then it's another matter.
Artist Klaus Oldenburg. Rizzoli has just published the book Klaus Oldenburg, Multiples in Retrospect, 1964 to 1990. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Charlie Sifford describes himself as the one black man who wouldn't disappear from the game of golf. In 1961, he became the first black golfer admitted to the PGA. Now he's a regular in the senior PGA Tour. But he says blacks are still not welcome in the game of golf. Coming up, we talk with Charlie Sifford. And film critic John Powers reviews Honeymoon in Vegas by the same filmmaker who gave us The Freshman. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio in Washington, I'm Barbara Campbell. President Bush said today he is approving the sale of F-16 fighter jets to Taiwan worth $6 billion. The president made the announcement at a campaign appearance at General Dynamics' Fort Worth, Texas plant, where the F-16 is made. He also announced billions of dollars in aid to farmers today, some for those whose crops were damaged by natural disasters, like Hurricane Andrew, and some for wheat exporters who compete with foreign growers subsidized by their governments. In Rockville, Maryland today, Governor Bill Clinton said the reason there's less money for needy students and more cuts in college courses this fall is because the Bush administration's economic policies are disjointed and its education plan is underfunded. NPR's Claudio Sanchez reports.
Governor Clinton told a small crowd of community college students and teachers that under the Bush presidency, states have been forced to fend for themselves and cut deeper into education funding than ever before. By allowing that to happen, Clinton said, President Bush is undermining the nation's ability to educate and train its workforce.
So all of America's economic future, our total productivity growth, our ability to generate wealth depends on now in this global economy, our capacity to offer 100% of our high school graduates and our older workers coming back the opportunity to come to a place like this, and we're cutting it off.
Clinton said his national apprenticeship program for high school students and an expanded college loan program are the cornerstones of his plan for creating 8 million new jobs if he's elected. He'll discuss that with Latino leaders tonight. In Washington, I'm Claudio Sanchez reporting.
Tourism in Miami was dealt a hard blow by Hurricane Andrew, and the success of rebuilding the area's economy depends largely on when that industry can bounce back. NPR's Derek Revron reports.
Tourism accounts for more than one-fourth of the jobs in Dade County. When Andrew hit, the industry was set to exceed last year's record of 10.9 million visitors. Now, Merritt Sterheim, executive director of the Miami Visitors and Conventions Bureau, is uncertain if the industry can bounce back by the all-important winter tourism season. In fact, the only major tourism attraction that was actually damaged is the Florida Everglades. So Miami's major problem is convincing the world that it's still open for business. That's why tourism officials are scrambling to keep business coming in. They're calling travel agents and hotel chains around the world and taking out ads in newspapers. Sterheim believes that tourism will recover, but he doesn't know when. In Miami, I'm Derek Revron reporting.
Homeless victims of Hurricane Andrew are trickling into tent cities in Florida, although the facilities set up by the military were not scheduled to open until tomorrow. Housing Secretary Jack Kemp noted that people are staying away because they want to protect their homes, and he's not so sure building tent cities was so wise. Stock prices closed higher on Wall Street today. This is NPR. Two brothers alleged to be key members of John Gotti's organized crime family have disappeared on the eve of their arraignment on racketeering charges. One of their lawyers said today he is afraid they are victims of foul play, but federal authorities think John and Joseph Gambino jumped bail to avoid possible life prison terms. The judge in federal court in New York is to decide whether the trial should proceed without the defendants. The use of chemical weapons was banned in 1925, but after more than 20 years, negotiators from 38 nations have completed a treaty which also forbids the production and stockpiling of poison gas. NPR's Ann Garrels has this report.
The Bush administration called the Chemical Weapons Treaty a major achievement for arms control and the United States. It includes far-reaching verification provisions covering not only military sites, but civilian industrial and scientific plants, too. The treaty goes to the United Nations General Assembly for approval. The signing by individual countries is expected early next year. But according to U.S. officials, as many as half the 15 or so nations believed to possess chemical weapons may not initially sign on and will continue to pose a threat. Though the treaty won't solve the proliferation problem, it will make it more costly for those who wish to make or use the weapons. And though the treaty doesn't spell out penalties for those who sign and violate the treaty, it does spell out international standards of behavior. I'm Ann Garrels in Washington.
Philippine civil defense authorities say entire communities have been turned into islands surrounded by mud and steaming debris from Mount Pinatubo. The avalanches and flooding were triggered by monsoon rains. At least 17 people have been killed in the last 2 weeks. Tens of thousands have been forced out of their homes, and volcano experts say Pinatubo is showing increasing signs that it will erupt again. This is NPR in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. My guest, Charlie Sifford, was the first black admitted into the PGA, the Professional Golfers Association. And he was the first black man to play on the PGA Tour. To get into the PGA, he had to challenge the Caucasian Clause that remained in the association's constitution until 1961. It stated, professional golfers of the Caucasian race, over the age of 18, shall be eligible for membership. During Sifford's career, he's won over $1 million in official prize money. Now at the age of 69, he plays on the senior PGA Tour. But in his new memoir, Just Let Me Play, Sifford says there is still no place for a black man in professional golf. He has often been called the Jackie Robinson of golf, but he doesn't like the comparison.
No, I don't think it works. I think Jackie Robinson did a better job than I did. I mean, we have hundreds and hundreds of black professional baseball players that are making millions and millions of dollars. And I only have four or five blacks playing golf, so I don't think I did a good a job as Jackie Robinson. Maybe I did a good job as Jackie Robinson, but I wasn't as successful as Jackie Robinson was for what I've done.
Your introduction to golf was as a caddy at a country club in North Carolina. It is a country club that blacks were not allowed to be members of. Blacks were not allowed to actually play on the course. So how did you actually learn to play on a whites-only course when you were a caddy?
I guess it's just a gift from God, you know, because I used to get out and I'm from a very, very poor family. I had my father and mother, they had six kids, and my father was a laborer. And when I'd get out of school in the afternoon, I would go to the golf course, and I just picked the game up. And when I was 13 years old, I could shoot 70, even par, 71, one over par, and it's something like that. It took a liking to the game.
Would you have to sneak onto the course to play, or would they let you play as a caddy even though the course was officially closed to blacks?
Well, we had a day we called Caddy Day Monday. But sometime I would slip out on the golf course and... That's why the gentleman that owned it, Sutton Alexander, very nice man, and God bless him, he passed. And he used to let me take me out and we play, you know. But after all the members of the golf course got to talking about it, so he asked my mother and father if they would let me go somewhere where I could play golf, and that was to Philadelphia. I had an uncle up there. And I went to Philadelphia in 1939.
Because there was a public course nearby that you could play on.
Right, it's still there.
Now, you became Billy Eckstein's golf teacher, valet, and partner on the course.
Mm-hmm.
So you traveled with the band?
Oh, yeah.
That must have been fun.
I was in charge of the musicians. And I was in charge of taking his clothes to the theater. And when I would take his clothes to the theater, I would head for the golf course, wherever I could find one, and do my little thing.
So, now, Eckstein played golf, and you say that you used to hustle with Eckstein. What were your hustles like?
I taught him how to play golf. We used to go to these different cities, you know, and you know how some of the guys are. You see Billy Eckstein making all this money, so they try to sneak out to the golf course and rob him. So we were prepared for that. We used to go in different places, you understand, and the guys used to call him up to come play. So he said, okay, but I had to bring my chauffeur with me. You know, I was the chauffeur and the pro, too. So we used to go out, and if I see that the guys couldn't couldn't beat him, you understand, I'd be playing turkey. I'd be hitting my ball all out through the woods and anywhere until things get real tough, then I would come in, you know. So one match I played, this guy, you understand, he told me, after we got through playing, he said, "What's your name?" So I said, "My name is Charlie Clifford." This guy said, "Man, if I didn't know your name was Charlie Clifford, I swear you was Charlie Clifford."
What's the most money you won in one of these hustles?
Oh, I don't know. I don't want to tell that. But I made a decent living plan, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Decent living plan.
Were the people who you hustled usually black or white?
Anything come along. Didn't pick them.
Now, you say that being the first black on the PGA Tour was one of the most frightening and dangerous things you ever faced. What was dangerous about it?
Well, could you imagine a black man going to North Carolina to play in a PGA-sponsored golf tournament with all white players and one black the first time it ever happened? That's enough to be afraid of. And
were you threatened?
Oh, well, I wasn't going to go. I called my wife, and she's responsible for everything that's happened to me in golf because I asked her, "What about going to Greensboro?" So she said, "Go ahead on down there. They're not going to bother you." So there I went.
So were you threatened?
Oh, yes. After the first round of the tournament, I shot 68 and led the tournament the first day. And as I went back to these friends' house I was living in, it wasn't in the hotels, and the phone rang, and they asked to speak to Charlie Clifford. So I asked the phone, so this guy said, "You a Charlie Clifford?" So I said, "Yeah." So he said, "You better not bring your back to the golf course tomorrow." So I told him, I said, "Well, I tee off at 9:40. And whatever you're going to do, you better get ready to do it because I'll be there." So I went out, teed off, and about 10 or 12 guys started on number one, and it took them to the 14th hole before they could arrest them all.
What were they doing?
Hollering, yelling, calling me names. Didn't hit me, which thank God they didn't. I'm sure I wouldn't, you know, may not have been here today as a successful black professional. Well, that's why I said that Jack Robinson, you understand, he's in a different category to me than he was in a ballpark. See, I'm out between those ropes and touchable, you know. Anything could happen, you know. But in the ballpark, he's more safer than I were.
Of course, he had a lot of things thrown at him, didn't he?
He had eight guys with him anyway, you know. And I'm nobody but me and 14 golf clubs.
Well, how did you golf that day? You know, there's such a hush that falls over the crowd when somebody's taking their swing, and here you had all these hostile people out to get you who were hollering and insulting you as you were playing. Did you play well that day?
I think I shot 73 that day.
What was par?
71. I played well behind that because, you know, I had made up my mind I was going to go through with it anyway, you know, as long as someone didn't hit me, you know. So, you know, ain't nothing they can do to turn me around, you know, to break my concentration and break my determination because I had started and I wasn't going to quit.
My guest is Charlie Clifford. His new memoir is about how he broke the color barrier in professional golf. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Charlie Sifford. He was the first black man in the PGA and the first black to play on the PGA Tour. So when you started on the PGA Tour, even though they had let you in, were there still tournaments that were there still events that you were barred from, or were you?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, there were?
Oh, sure.
How would that work?
After I got through playing in Greensboro, North Carolina, I got in my car that Sunday night, and I drove all the way to Houston, Texas, where they used to have the Houston Open. And when I got there Wednesday morning to sign up to get in the tournament, I was ran away, told me I couldn't play. And there was a guy that headed the PGA then by the name of Joe Black. So I went to him and asked him what was the thing. I got, what was the reason? I had my approved player's card. Why couldn't I play? So he said, well, there's nothing we could do about it because it's 1962, you know, that Houston wasn't segregated then. You know, everything didn't come down to 64, you know.
How much would you fight when you were turned away, and how much did you feel like you should be, you know, the gentleman and be polite because it might hurt your reputation in the PGA if you became too militant?
Well, I wasn't going to be militant because I knew that's just what they wanted me to be, you know. So I just got in my car and drove on down the highway and got me a towel and just cried and got it off my shoulder and just kept on making me want to play more, you know. And I think when they turned me away in Houston, I think if they had let me play in Houston, I may not never play golf because that really made me mad, you know. And I really wanted to play after they turned me away, after I had the approved player's card in my pocket. But
now, what would happen when you would play in a tournament on a course or in a club that barred blacks? Were you allowed in the clubhouse? Were you allowed in the locker room?
At the first beginning, I wasn't allowed in the club, and I wasn't allowed in the I had to go in the locker room to eat. I couldn't eat with them.
When did that start changing?
Oh, it started after 64, 65.
Mm-hmm. How much golf are you playing now?
Oh, I play golf just about every week. I'm playing on the senior tour now. Super seniors? I'm a super senior.
That's one of the really great things about golf, isn't it, that you don't have to give it up?
That's right. You can play till you get 100. Because if you take care of yourself like me, see, I take care of myself. I exercise, train, stay away from the ladies.
Do you feel that you still face discrimination?
Oh, yeah, of course. You know, I believe that there's, now don't get me wrong, I'm not prejudiced. There's some white people in this country will never accept a black man as a golfer. That's true.
Now, why do you think that is? What is it about golf that has been so resistant?
I don't know. That's what the first, when I was 13 years old and had to leave North Carolina to come to Pennsylvania to play golf, I always wondered why that they didn't want a black man to play golf. I've proved everything. I proved to the world that a black man could play golf and be a gentleman. They never seen me out on the tour with three or four different women. They've never seen me with no women. I've never been with any. They've never saw me bothering any of their wives. So I don't know what they're afraid of. And we outnumbered anyway. If they had 20 blacks out there, well, hell, you got 4,500 whites. So, I mean, you know, well, what is it? We don't have any tails. I just don't understand it.
I guess it has something to do with how golf was always a part of this country club system. You know, that...
You know, you might have a point there. I think you do have a point there. But, you know, the country club thing, I mean, it doesn't mean anything. They open up every country club in the country. The average black guy can't afford it anyway. How many black people you think can pay $50,000 a year to be a member of the golf course? Hell, the average black person don't make $50,000 a year. You know, so how can he afford that? So they're stupid for saying it. You know, they don't want nothing. They ought to open it up, and there wouldn't be nothing to it. They say, yeah, anybody got the bread, come on. You know, and hell, you wouldn't get that many. And the ones you get didn't know how to conduct themselves.
So what's your next big game?
Oh, I'm going to Charlotte, North Carolina, my hometown, to play next week.
Oh, you're not going to be on the course where you got started, are you?
No. No, we built another golf course. I wasn't allowed there either. But that don't bother me anymore. I just go out there and take off my shoes, go in the locker room, do just like the rest of them do, and better not be stopped. They don't. They know who I am, and they know I might fight back now. Before, I wouldn't fight back because I had to prove a point, but the point is proven now, and I'm proud of my book, and I know that some of the kids that read this book that want to gonna get interested in golf, and after next year, I want to see if I can get me a program started, that if I can get a grant from someone to, I don't know how I'm going to do it, but I would just like to go around the country and these high schools and colleges, you know, and introduce this game to the kids. I know we have some golfers out there. We just have to find them.
Well, I wish you good luck.
Thank you very much.
And thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank me. Thanks for talking to you.
Charlie Sifford's memoir is called Just Let Me Play, the story of the first black PGA golfer. We recorded our interview in the spring. This is Fresh Air. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Linda, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Terry, as you know, the president was in Florida and Louisiana yesterday. Today, we are following in his footsteps to see how it feels in those states today, asking about the recovery and what's going on now. The hurricane is playing into presidential politics. We're going to have a piece on incumbency and what it means to run for president as president, with all of this federal aid to hand out, as the president is doing today. We'll have a piece on how the two candidates stand on the issue of welfare, and we're going to take a look at Yugoslavia, at German nationalism, and at a UAW strike.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. In a summer of few movie comedies, critic John Power says he's glad there's Honeymoon in Vegas.
A good movie comedy doesn't simply make us laugh. It's buoyant. It keeps our spirits afloat from beginning to end, even when the jokes are sinking. And that's precisely what happens in Honeymoon in Vegas. Nicolas Cage is Jack Singer, a New York private eye who can't bring himself to marry his girlfriend Betsy, played by Sarah Jessica Parker. Finally, they do fly off to Vegas for a wedding. But before they can get hitched, Jack gets taken in a poker game by a professional gambler, Tommy Corman. Now Corman, played by James Caan, has gotten a glimpse of Betsy in the hotel lobby, and she's the spitting image of his dead wife. So he proposes a deal. He'll forgive Jack's debt if Jack'll loan him Betsy for the weekend. Jack agrees, unhappily, of course, and then discovers that Betsy and Tommy are about to fly off to Hawaii.
Come on, you're so, like, blithe about this all of a sudden. Like, you don't give a damn!
Of course I give a damn, but this was not my idea, okay, Jack? Poker was not my idea.
Would you please stop crucifying me with this?
See my bag?
He's gonna jump all over you the second he gets there.
Oh, then I'll let him, please, Jack. Give me a little credit.
He'll overcome you. I mean, what happens if you start screaming? It's like a jungle over there! He probably has servants and bodyguards, and believe me, they will drag you!
His son is gonna be there, Jack. His granddaughter, Tiffany, will be there.
She knows the kid's name already.
She does indeed. And even worse, she starts becoming attracted to Corman. You see, he didn't want her for sex after all. He's genuinely love-struck. He really wants to marry her. And she responds to his ardor, even as Jack frantically chases her from Vegas to Hawaii and back again. If you've seen Nick Cage in Vampire's Kiss, Moonstruck, or Wild at Heart, you already know he's the funniest actor of his generation. And as Jack, Cage gives another hilarious full-court press of a performance. He slouches and rants, clutches his forehead, goes dashing from place to place like Wile E. Coyote. There's a touch of the wounded beast to Cage that gives him his special charm. He's both cartoonish and warm. No easy trick. I kept thinking, if Cary Grant had been an orangutan, he would have been Nick Cage. That's meant as praise, by the way. The other stars fare less well. We never buy the romantic chemistry between Betsy and Corman. The main culprit is James Caan, who turns Corman into a menagerie of facial tics. This makes for some laughs, but ruins him as a romantic figure. The guy wouldn't have a prayer of winning over Betsy. Not that she is much more than a male fantasy. In L.A. Story, Sarah Jessica Parker turned a bubble-headed roller skater into a real charmer. She stole that picture. Here she's got very little to do except be the shapely corner of a love triangle. Honeymoon in Vegas was written and directed by Andrew Bergman, whose last movie was The Freshman. This new picture isn't that good, but it's crawling with the cockeyed marginalia that is Bergman's trademark. There's a running joke about Elvis impersonators, a droll cameo by basketball coach Jerry Tarkanian, even a sly swipe at Marlon Brando's Polynesian pretensions. Brando, you see, gave Bergman a terrible time when they were making The Freshman together. Honeymoon in Vegas is ephemeral summer fun, but it does capture the headlong goofiness of love. You'll walk from the theater in a giddy mood that'll stay with you the whole evening, even if you're already married.
John Powers is a cultural reporter for LA Weekly and writes about movies for New York Magazine. Fresh Air senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Richard Parker, Joyce Lieberman, Ron Barron, and Stephen Waterman. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Charlie Rich. He got his start making R&B records at the Sun Studios in Memphis. In the 70s, his recordings of The Most Beautiful Girl and Behind Closed Doors were big country pop hits. Now he has a new album that he says is the one he's always wanted to make. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.